Okay, thank you very much for inviting me. So this is a joint work with Nick Cross from Warwick University. Please feel free to jump into my talk anytime you want to. And please be brutal. The more brutal you are, the better the paper will be. So this is the structure of my talk. It's a standard intro context. I will spend a lot of time discussing empirical framework and a data estimation strategy. Before I jump into regression results, I have a tendency to present a lot of descriptive statistics. I mean, I firmly believe that if there is some substantial relationship, that should be visible by the first look of the descriptive statistics. I will spend quite a bit of time talking about the identification. We don't think we have endogeneity problem, but I mean, that's the game that is played in economics, so we're discussing quite a bit of details, economic significance, and then conclusion. Now, this paper is coming out of a very large and long ongoing project we had with Nick. It's a third paper in a series of papers in which we try to understand the nature and the sources of agglomeration economies in manufacturing activities in the United States. And we try to understand the effects of urbanization and economic geography on what we call various economic outcomes, whether it's a labor productivity, whether it's employment growth. I mean, we really are quite inclusive. So we already have two papers. We have two papers out. One is on the sources of spatial inequalities in the U.S., and the second one is on the effects. And this paper looks at the effects of agglomeration economies on labor productivity. So what is the big question where we try to put our paper? What is the context? We try to look at the sources of modern economic growth. And endogenous growth theories tells us that increasing returns to scales are at the heart of the modern sustainable economic growth as it emerged in many countries throughout the 19th century. Now, if we want to empirically examine the sources of increasing returns to scales, cities are ideal place to do it, because cities are the sources of increasing returns to scale, and the cities allow to study the nature and the sources of agglomeration economies, and hence to understand one of the mechanisms which leads to sustainable economic growth. Indeed, I mean, recent literature shows that if a country wants to be successful in terms of the economic development, economic growth, it must be successful in urbanizing its country. Now, why do we want to look at the United States at the turn of the 20th century? I mean, the U.S. is the ideal case study to analyze the effect of urbanization and agglomeration economies on economic growth and to learn lessons from the U.S. development. U.S. became leading industrial power exactly around the time. Timing is a bit contested, but we know from several studies that it was approximately around 1890 when the United States overtook Great Britain in labor productivity. And the United States stayed as a labor productivity leader for almost a century after that. We have various explanations why it happened. One explanation which emerged in the literature but still lacks any serious empirical underpinnings is the effects of urbanization on economic growth. And we know that urbanization and economic growth in the U.S. collided. So, turn of the 20th century, we have a second industrial revolution. So basically every single gadget, maybe except for microwave, which you know in a kitchen, emerged during the second industrial revolution. It's a period when countries moved away from the steam power to electricity. It is a watershed event, and U.S. took big advantage of it. At the same time, we know that at the time, U.S. experienced unprecedented increase in the population and urbanization, mostly in what is called manufacturing belt, so Midwest and New England. Nowadays, it is called a Rust Belt. So we have this situation, and we try to understand what is the causal effect of large urbanization increase and labor productivity growth around the time. So the general research question is really, what is the effect of urbanization and geographical concentration in the United States on labor productivity of U.S. industries? And the very specific question we ask is, what type of agglomeration economies were most important in the U.S. cities at the turn of the 20th century, and what is their effect on the labor productivity? So general research question is, basically, yes, urbanization is there. There is some kind of a black box. What is the effect of the black box on labor productivity growth? But we want to be slightly more ambitious, and we try to ask the question, okay, let's go inside the black box. Not only what is the effect of urbanization, but what type of agglomeration economies actually played a role during the time in the United States. I mean, those of you who are familiar with the endogenous growth theories, the famous Lucas's model from 1988, it's a human capital interaction spillovers. What he has in mind explicitly are cities. Okay, what he has in mind is one type of agglomeration economies, as I will explain in a few minutes, Jacobian externalities. So in a way, we try to test one of the ideas that Lucas had in his 1988 paper. 1988 paper. Okay, so just
by type of agglomerations,
I will go through it in a few minutes. I tell exactly what I mean by type of agglomeration, just in case something happens and I don't get to finish my presentation. Here are the results. So we distinguish two types of agglomeration economies. One is so-called Marshallian agglomeration economies, or intra-industry agglomeration. Okay, so you have the same industry located in the same place, so you have a lot of spillovers. It can be all kinds of spillovers. We don't distinguish what type. We are agnostic about that, but we say this is intra-industry agglomeration economies. Second type of agglomeration economies are so-called Jacobian agglomeration economies. Those are inter-industry spillovers. The name is after Jane Jacobs, who was a Chicago sociologist with whom Lucas had a lot of interactions. And when you read work on the agglomeration economies, Chicago PhD graduates, Chicago scholars are hugely influenced by the work on Jane Jacobs. So basically what we run in our paper is a horse race, which type of agglomeration economies mattered for the labor productivity growth. So what we find really very robust positive effect of these Marshallian externalities. This is called Marshall Arrow Roemer externalities, or intra-industry externalities, throughout the period 1880-1930, irrespective of sub-periods or estimation techniques. And we find what we call reasonably robust effect of Jacobian or inter-industry externalities. I will explain later on what I mean by reasonably robust. It's not 100%, okay, but that is something that we think is important to consider. Most importantly, we have some new finding which has not appeared in the agglomeration literature. There is a nonlinear effect of inter-industry externalities. Those inter-industrial Jacobian externalities matter only for large cities. They do not matter for small cities. So we have a U-shape. We have a U-shape pattern, which is, as I said, which is reasonably robust.
If you say reasonably robust, you mean positive or negative?
I mean, sine is one. It's a U-shaped pattern. So that is in the first derivative is negative, then it's positive. By reasonably robust is I mean that in some time periods it's not there. In some time periods it's there. We ran semi-parametric regressions. I will show you semi-parametric graphs. Okay. So in the parametric regression we just force data to follow U-shaped pattern. In semi-parametric regression we are agnostic on the shape of the pattern, and you will see it's not 100% U. It's a squiggly U. That's why it's reasonably robust. Okay. As for Marshallian externalities, it's positive and robust irrespective of what we do. So what is our contribution? So this paper contributes to, we believe, three strands of the literature. So there is a large literature on the nature and the effects of agglomeration economies. And we examine them in the very rapidly industrializing country. Okay. We contribute to the literature on the sources of U.S. economic growth. And we believe, most importantly, to the growing literature on the effects of urbanization and economic growth. And as we say, if a country wants to be successful from the point of view of economic growth, it needs to urbanize. Okay. So what we are, in terms of literature review, where do we stand? We are merging two different literatures. One is the literature on the U.S. growth at the turn of the 20th century. Of course, we are not the first one to examine that period. There are several explanations. There's an explanation based on the capital growth, role of natural resources, the fantastic paper arguing that basically U.S. did not suffer from natural resource curse. There's a great research on the role of the large enterprises and the emergence of the distributional and transportation network. The role of labor productivity is explored by the unique paper by Steve Broadbury and Doug Irwin, Technological Progress, of course. But rapid urbanization, it's acknowledged, it's there, but we really do not have a very firm understanding of what's going on. We have some papers which try to shed some light on it, but there are still some problems in the methodology of those papers. What they find is there is a correlation between urbanization and industrialization, okay, but there is still debate about the direction of causality, and we really don't know much about it in general. So what we are contributing to this strand of the literature. Okay, we believe that it is very important. If suddenly you have a country where cities grow rapidly, okay, especially in the Midwest, then there is an effect, and we try to estimate that net effect. Okay, there is a gigantic literature on the effect of agglomeration economies on various economic outcomes, whether it's employment growth of TFP or labor productivity. And we focus it on the literature which specifically talks to us. It's a literature which tries to distinguish what is more important. Is it inter-industry externalities or intra-industry externalities? Is it better, or does the fact that you are a textile firm and you locate to a district full of textile firms, or is it better that you locate into the districts where there are various industries? What helps you more? Being in an environment with the same firms in the same industry, or being in an environment with the firms of different industries? Lukat will tell you that different industries helps productivity growth. Cross-pollinization, knowledge spillovers across different industries is much more productive than just being in the same in the district with the same industries. Marshall, on the other hand, will tell you otherwise. He will say, you are a textile firm, go to a district with a lot of textile firms. There's a specialization of labor. They know how to do things. They are much more productive. So what we are doing here, we are really running a horse race between those two different explanations. So large literature, the revival of the literature goes back to Ed Glazius et al. Paper from 1992. And we have a nice meta-study from 2009. And we try to look at what are the overall effects of Marshallian and Jacobian externalities. And what is kind of comforting for us, that basically, whether you use individual level data or you use more aggregate level data, I mean, overall effects really do not change. We are using aggregate level data, so this is slightly comforting. Another thing that is comforting, it really does not depend whether you use wages or labor productivity as a dependent variable. And this is comforting for us because we are using labor productivity measure. I would distinguish two strands of studies. One study is look at the effects of Marshallian and Jacobian externalities on employment growth. And here, basically, the results suggest that Jacobian externalities or inter-industry externalities matter a lot. And they positively affect employment growth. Okay, we have plenty of studies over here. On the other hand, when we look at the studies using either gross output, labor productivity, or TFP data, their results are not almost opposite, but they suggest that those are Marshallian externalities which matter a lot, not so much as Jacobian externalities. Okay, so we do not want to say what is more important. We do not contribute to that distinction. I'm making the distinction because it is important from the point of view of the data that we have and the methodology that we are employing. There are a couple of studies which look exactly at the time period we investigate. There is one nice study by Bostic et al. They're looking at the growth, productivity growth in 79 metropolitan areas in 1880 and 1990. They have, however, quite difficult identification problems, and they find that there is no effect of agglomeration economies on labor productivity growth, only capital labor ratio. Now, this might be true, but this is kind of hard to square with the gigantic secondary literature that we have on labor productivity growth at that time. Then we have a study by Suko Kim from 2006, where he uses a firm level data for the period 1850-1880. However, Suko Kim does not deal with the issue of endogeneity at all. So what he reports are what I would call sophisticated correlations. And what he finds that, yes, urban areas do provide labor productivity kickoff. So it's, I mean, being in an urban area helps you to be more productive. Okay, but as I said, his estimates are more of a sophisticated correlations rather than causality. Okay, so what we have really various approaches, various empirical strategies, various dependent variables, and what we do in our paper, we follow the strategy by Ed Glazier and others, in which the growth of labor productivity of an industry in a city is regressed on the initial values of agglomeration economies. This is, in fancy language, it is called dynamic externalities in the literature, and our regression equation looks like this. So what we have over here, we have a labor productivity growth, so we have a value added per worker in a city C, industry S, at time t plus 1, divided by value added per worker in city C, industry S, at time t. We have a measure of Marshallian externalities, measure of Jacobian externalities, we have various controls, we have dummies, and we have an error term. There are, of course, challenges to that empirical methodology, and I will discuss those challenges in quite a few details. How do I define agglomeration economies? Here we are not innovative. We follow the literature, and we use the standard definition of Marshallian externalities. It's just a simple specialization, which means it is employment in city C and industry S divided by the total employment in city C. So it's a share of employment in a particular industry in the city C. Jacobian externalities, it is a version of the Herfindahl index. Okay. So we have those two. We have those two measures. What are our main data sources?
May I ask?
Yeah.
Why these measures are in relative sizes? Isn't it important how big they are in absolute sizes? If you have a city like New York, you can have both huge industries.
Yeah.
Each industry could be huge, and still the industries could be diversified within the city. Why relative
sizes? This is relative of your particular industry. Okay, so you ask about the overall size of the city. Yes, that's fine. We can measure it. We measure it with the total population in the city, or you can measure it in our specification with a dummy. This is an important effect. But what we want to know, if you are a firm in apparel industry, okay, you move to the New York City. You move to the New York City because it's a large city. This is one big effect. But we really want to distinguish whether you get more productivity advantage from locating in the New York City because there are a lot of similar apparel industries, or you get the advantage because there's a machine building industry which can get you better machines to make your apparel. That's my relative.
I don't understand it, but if you industry in absolute size could be huge in the city, much, much bigger than in some,
yeah,
I don't know, Waco, Texas or whatever, but still, even though the industry in absolute size is huge in the city, in relative terms it could be small. Maybe it doesn't make any problem, I don't know.
We control for the overall size of the city in the regression. So this is controlled for, okay? What we are interested in is not the overall size, effect of the overall size of the city, because this is important. I'm not saying it's not, but it's still a black box. We want to go inside the black box. If you go inside the black box, you need to make more qualified distinction over here. Yeah.
How does distance is assumed here? Because to me, it should not matter whether you close to, if you have reach or contact with other factory within a city, or if the two factories are connected by the rail or by the sea, so if you're at the port,
yeah. Okay.
It's almost the same as you would be in a city together with the other company.
Now, over here, well, as for this, well, we don't have explicit distance measure. So what we take, we have an industry in a particular city, okay? In the initial version of the paper, we controlled for a distance to the nearby cities, but it really did not matter. Did not matter much. We're gonna have explicit account for the transportation network toward the end of the paper. Okay, so stay tuned. Okay, we have it there. But I mean, in terms of a distance, I would be slightly more careful. If you are at a port, yes, your transportation costs are lower than if you are somewhere in the Midwest. True. But we will have to know. Okay. Well, you will have to know. Okay. You will have to know the location of a firm in a particular city and its distance to the to the nearest port or to the nearest canal or the nearest railway line. We don't have that kind of detailed geographical information. So basically, in the regression analysis, you have an industry which is in a city. So basically, for all industries in a city, we can create only one measure, a distance from the city to the port. Okay, we can estimate it, but if it's the same as if you have a just simple dummy. Okay, it just siphons out by the dummy. So basically, what you can estimate is a general effect of a distance of a city to the nearest port to all industries, and you have some kind of an average effect. And while it is important, I'm not saying we know, this is not what we are interested in. This can be for a different paper. Here we are interested in those two effects only. For what you are saying, we control with the city industry dummies.
Yeah. I thought more like if there are homogeneous center, mm-hmm. like three centers, and in the middle there is a center that produces something, and the distance to all homogeneous centers is sort of very close. This middle center has sort of segregation or access to all the markets, right?
It's not really the case of the United States. I mean, we could talk about the regional centers of New York City. We could talk about the regional center of Chicago, maybe something in the Midwest. But it wouldn't be possible to estimate it in a convincing way with the data we have. You will have to have a really firm level or planned level data to do that more convincingly. I mean, we're going to deal with transportation toward the end. It's a nice surprise, okay? But as I said, in that respect, we are humble. We ask this particular question. We control for what you are saying with the city industry dummies. In my very first version, I had the distance from every single city to the canal, to the port, to the nearest railway line. But because we don't know where in the city the industry is, we don't have that information. So basically, you have one distance for all industries. We can have it there, okay, we get the number, but it's not interesting for us. So you put the dummy in it, and you control for it as well, in that respect.
I have one more question.
Yeah.
The effect you want to estimate is basically learning from other firms in the industry in the Marshallian approach, and learning from firms in other industries in the city. In the Jacobian.
No. We are agnostic about what are the forces within those externalities, what are the forces within those externalities. It could be learning, it could be matching, it could be sorting. There are various agglomeration channels through which it works. Okay, we have good data, but we don't have the data are not good enough to distinguish whether it's a learning, matching, sorting, or something else. We will have to have a firm level data. This is a great question. I said current research on agglomeration economics tries to tackle with this issue. In this context, we really can't say. Okay, so I mean, I said that we go from city as a black box to something more inside, Marshallian versus Jacobians, but it can't go as deep as you suggest. So we cannot make any qualified judgment. This is going to be a net effect. Mm-hmm. Net effect. Which means that if it is positive, then agglomeration benefits are larger than agglomeration costs. But what constitutes agglomeration benefits, we can't say. It could be learning, it could be matching, it could be sorting, it could be everything together. Okay. So this is still, it's a smaller black box, but it's still black box, I would say. Yeah. What are the data? Main sources, main data sources is the U.S. Census of Manufacturers, 1880-1930. And U.S. Census of Manufacturers provides the data at the level of U.S., states, counties, but also cities. And so we create a city-industry pair at SIC's three-digit level. And let me show you exactly what I have in mind. So this is an example from the 1880 U.S. Census of Manufacturers. This is the city of Albany in New York. Okay, this is information. This is the information that the census provides. Okay, so we see we have we have a name of the city, we have industries in the city. This is a list of industries. So what I did, I coded those industries into SIC3 digilevel classification. We have information on number of establishments, capital, employment, so total wages, value added of materials, and value of products. So from this, we calculated the measure of labor productivity. Some ask the question, why not TFP? The reason why we are not calculating TFPs, even though we have capital, is that the capital is probably the most problematic measure over here. And most importantly, we don't have information on the value of capital from 1920. So we really can't say much about TFP, okay? But we can say something about labor productivity. Data are not perfect. So what are the issues? Let me start with here. Now, from workers versus employees, we have a data on employees only from 1890 onwards. So we limit ourselves to workers only, or blue collar workers. But we don't think this is much of a problem, because employees is a blue collar and white collar workers. I mean, white collar workers start emerging around that time. Okay, even though they increase in numbers, the share is still quite small. So the fact that we don't have a management in it doesn't really create much of a problem. Okay, value added. So sense of manufacturers excluded some of the items which we have to looked up. Price index. Okay, what we have are nominal values, and we need real values. Ideally, we would like to have a city industry deflator. Okay, don't have it, doesn't exist. Even today, I mean, it's very difficult. So what we are doing, we are making an assumption that the national market was integrated well enough so that we use US price deflator. This is the best that we can do. And we believe that if there is any intercity price differences, it is captured by the city and industry dummies. Okay, that's the best that we can do at the moment. There is this issue of miscellaneous industries. There is this category in the U.S. Census of Manufacturers called all other industries, which includes all industries which could not be reported by the Census of Manufacturers because there were just only one or two firms and you could recognize those firms. Okay, so it's not really typical SIC3 digilevel 399 industry. Analysis works with or without them. Without them, results are slightly less significant, but we keep them in because it is an important information. This miscellaneous industry tells you something about diversity in the town. Okay, the share of miscellaneous industries as the cities grew are larger is relatively small. So, yes, wearing hard on my sleeves, it is an issue. We deal with the best we can. Price indices come from the U.S. Historical Statistics Millennial Edition. We do have, from a paper by Kane Peterson, industry-specific price indices at the SIC2 digit level by the end in 1900. Okay, so we really can't push it to the 1930. We did a sensitivity analysis, and results are very, very, very similar. Okay, so...
May I ask, yeah, what are cities? How big it must be to be counted as city?
At least 20,000 inhabitants.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I get to do what kind of cities we have in, how the number of cities change over time in a few minutes. So, estimation strategy. We start with the OLS, with the two-way cluster robust standard errors, where we are clustering at the level of cities as well as at the level of industries. Now, because of Jacobian externalities exhibiting a nonlinear pattern, we also do semi-parametric regression using the Robinson's estimator, in which we don't assume any functional form for Jacobian externalities, and I will show the graphs later on. We do it for those periods over here, and we also do two-stage least square. We do two-stage least square with a different set of instruments and two-way clustering. Why? There is a concern that our measures of externalities might be endogenous. So there is a concern that city in 1880 having certain level of marginal externalities might be endogenous to the subsequent growth of labor productivity between 1880 and 1920, for example. We think it's rubbish, but there is this concern. And why is there a concern? There could be some omitted variable bias. So we put inside in regression, in addition to city industry controls, we put the state level variables. So we believe we're siphoning out as much as possible in terms of omitted variable bias. But there could be a situation of a forward-looking behavior of firms. So what can happen? Okay, if firm can predict this error term, so if firm can predict that a city with a very particular Marshallian externalities is conducive to the subsequent productivity growth, they can move in anticipation to that city. If this happens, that our measure of Marshallian and Jacobian externalities will be endogenous. We do not think that firms were that forward-looking, that they could predict 40 years ahead which city would be conducive to industrial growth. But we still try. We are very conservative, and we try to find appropriate estimates. Why don't we think that this is a big concern? And where does the identification of instruments come from? It's the nature of the second industrial revolution. Okay. So second industrial revolution is a period of watershed changes. You have a change of the general purpose technology from steam to electricity. You have an introduction of new techniques, and it's very difficult to predict, 5-year horizon, let alone 10 or 20-year horizon. A typical example is car industry. Okay, so we know that by 1920, Detroit was the center of the car industry, and it was Henry Ford. But what was the center of the car industry in 1900? It wasn't Detroit, it was New York City. And it wasn't internal combustion engine as a winning technology, it was electricity. So when we look at the history of car industry as an example, Detroit, the first firm, the car industry emerged around in the second half of the 1880s. By 1900, it wasn't mature industry, but it wasn't a brand new industry. So the first car industry entering Detroit area was Oldsmobile in 1902, and Henry Ford got there in 1903. So if he was that forward looking, he would be in Detroit in 1880. Okay, so really the dramatic nature of the second industrial revolution makes us believe that forward-looking behavior is very difficult to achieve. Example from the present day, our recent history, Silicon Valley. Could we predict in 1980 that when Hewlett Packard opened a garage in Silicon Valley, that Silicon Valley would become the center of the IT industry? It wasn't clear. It could have been Seattle, it could have been Silicon Valley, it could have been somewhere else. Once the center is established, then we can make a claim that firms can be forward-looking. But when you have a watershed changes and the changes are dramatic, then it's very difficult to make that kind of prediction. So the only way our variables are endogenous if that forward-looking behavior is there, and we do not believe, and historical evidence suggests that this really isn't the case. Nevertheless, there is a concern, so we try to deal with it. We first try to look at the literature, what are the possible approaches. There are several approaches to endogeneity of agglomeration. One is do nothing. Okay, that's a legitimate approach. Use very long lag values, either population or population trends. We can't go back to the 18th century. We simply don't have the data. Try to use geographical instruments. We don't have any suitable geographical instruments at the city level, or internal instruments using the dynamic panel. I tried that. It actually worked quite all right. Okay, but we decided for a different strategy. We came up with the three instruments, but at the end chose to work with two. One instrument is so-called Bartek instrument, which is used widely in the regional literature. Okay, what is the idea of the Bartek instrument? Bartek instrument predicts the level of employment in the city using the national trends in employment. So, level of employment in 1890 in Detroit is going to be predicted by the growth of national employment in the United States. And the identification strategy is that conditional of controls, the growth of national level of employment in industry S cannot predict city industry labor productivity growth. So here is an so basically here the national level of employment is a strong instrument. However, you can't make a city level predictions with it. Okay, so this is widely used instruments, and hence we created a similar instruments for our Marshallian externalities and for our Jacobian externalities. This is one instrument. Second instrument, this is a really old-fashioned instrument which I rediscovered only recently. It is so-called rank-based instrument. Goes back to the 1950s to the idea of Darwin. So what is the main idea? Main idea, first of all, we need to create a strong instrument, something that is strongly correlated with our dependent endogenous variable. So what we do, we rank the values of the Marshallian and Jacobian externalities respectively across all cities and assign the value 1 to, let's say, 300. Okay, it's a national ranking. Okay, so the car industry in Detroit relative to the car industry in Cincinnati. It's not a ranking within the city. So again, it's a national ranking. And the identification assumption, again, is that conditional on controls national ranking of the values of Marshallian and Jacobian externalities cannot predict city industrial labor productivity growth. In other words, just because you are nationally the second best industry doesn't mean that you're going to be hugely successful in a particular city. Okay? And the idea is, again, unpredictability of technological progress. Can you say that just because you are the most successful rubber industry in Cincinnati, you're going to be successful 20 years down the road? Not really. We know that Akron, Ohio, turned out to be a center of the rank. It's a rank. So it's a strong.
Based on a relative share of labor within an industry.
No, this is just a rank. So basically, you calculate Marshallian externalities for every city and every industry. You take. You have for each city, you have, let's say, 200 industries. We have 100 cities. You have 3,000 of them. Okay, you rank them, 1 to 3,000. That the number is the instrument. The number is highly correlated with your actual value, but it's a national rank. Okay, and the identification strategy, identification assumption is that firm cannot predict from the national ranking whether the future labor productivity in a particular city will be.
Going to the previous comment,
yeah.
May it be that if in New York the rubber industry employs 100,000 people, but it's only 1% of the labor force.
Okay.
And there is other city that employs 10,000 people.
Okay.
But it's like whole city.
Yeah.
Then which of the two would be ranked higher?
No, it depends on the relative position of the city. So, if you have one city where everyone is in the rubber industry, then well, it's a relative position not within the city industry, in all industries in all cities. Okay, so we are not having a
city. So, you can have more first ranks, right?
Well, I mean, it depends. That doesn't have to be. Okay, so you have all industries in all cities create one big column. You don't have a city specific rank, you don't have industry specific rank. No, it's a national rank of all industries. So, if it's a one city, which is all rubber industry, okay, which has a value of one, okay, it's probably going to be nationally high, okay. Next to it's going to be something of 0.92. So if you have in Pittsburgh, most of the people work in iron and steel. The second one's going to be in Pittsburgh. But there is other industry in Pittsburgh, which is probably, I don't know, apparel or textile. It's going to be probably quite low. Okay, it's a national ranking. Okay. The idea is similar to Bartik, but instead of using the predicted employment growth, we are using rank instrument. Why are we using this rank instrument? In the Bartik case, you need to have a national trend in employment. So if I am to instrument my Marshallian externalities for the year 1880, I need to know what happened to the employment growth between 1870 and 1880, and I don't know it. Okay. We don't have it. We can calculate Bartik instruments only from 1890 onwards. However, with the rank, I can do it for 1880 as well. Okay. So those instruments are very strong instruments. They are not weak, and this is the identification assumption. Very originally, we had the heteroscedasticity-based instance, but I'm going to skip that because we decided not to use it anymore. Okay, so how do our data look like in terms of number of cities? So we see the number of cities does change over time. Okay, so increases until 1900, and then it goes down by 1930. So question that I usually get is, I mean, is there any sample selection going on? I mean, we don't think so. I mean, the decision whether a city is included in the U.S. Census manufacturer depended on the budget of the U.S. Census. Okay, so they had money, they could do the census, they included the city. Basically, the reason why there are only 59 cities in 1930 because of the Great Depression. They simply did not have resources to do census at the same level as, let's say, in the 1910 or in 1900. You can include all cities in our regression analysis, or you can trace the cities across time. We did both, and really results did not qualitatively change. And if you don't see any obvious sample selection, I'm of the opinion that we should include all cities because it provides information. Okay, here is a graph of very well matching cities over time. So this is the number of cities matched for each of the time period that we are investigating. And as you see, yes, here are cities entering to the sample, here are cities exiting to the sample. We examine those cities in great details, whether getting a new city is going to bias our sample or whether city exiting is going to bias our sample. And there isn't much of a difference. In terms of cities entering the sample, the average Marshallian and Jacobian externalities are more or less the same as cities already in the sample. Cities exiting the sample, Marshallian externalities are slightly higher, and the difference is not statistically significant. Okay, so that was the good news for us. Now, let me run you through several descriptive statistics to see what's going on with the data. So one of the arguments that we are making is that this is the period of Second Industrial Revolution. So let's have a look at the share of employment in the industries, something that we call traditional industries, and then industries we call industries of Second Industrial Revolution. So we clearly see that industries of the Second Industrial Revolution in 1880 had relatively small shares of employment, which then increases quite significantly. Petroleum refining is a typical example, and this is where Rockefeller made his fortune. Okay. Now, in terms of traditional industries, we have a general decline in the employment in those industries. Here we have just example of cities by the level of specialization and diversification. So, not surprisingly, large cities, San Francisco, New York City, Boston, Philadelphia consistently, are pretty highly diversified cities. So, while these are the small cities, you probably, not that you've never heard of them, but many cities are not that, or towns are not very well known. So smaller cities tend to be more specialized. Okay, this is a huge area for future research that Nick and I intend to conduct. I apologize for the. You probably don't see very well in the back. So what we try to do in those two graphs is the following. On the horizontal axis, we have a city population in 1900. And on the vertical axis, we have a degree of specialization, and here we have a degree of diversity. So this is the measure of Marshallian externalities, and this is the measure of Jacobian externalities. Okay, so we found this relationship are very, very interesting. There are outliers. Here we have Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh, even though it is a large city, it is a highly specialized city. We have a Cleveland over here, also quite specialized. We have a Detroit over here. Still, I mean, in 1920, Detroit would be somewhere over here, a big city, hugely specialized. But in 1900, it was still among rather diversified cities. Cities. the graph that actually blew my mind, and I got apologies, I thought it would be better. So this is just a first order look at the scatter plot. This is the degree of specialization, which is Marshall externalities, and this is the value added per worker. This is in 1900. We have a positive relationship. You can play around with the optimized positive relation is going to be still there, but this is something we did not expect. So we have a degree of variety over here, and we have a value added per worker. This is again scatter plot, but scatter plots are very often very revealing, and we have a significant U-shaped pattern. Okay, we didn't expect this. Actually, we didn't know what to expect. So when I plotted the results, I looked at it, I mean, wow. So we decided that actually probably there is something more going on, just a simple linear relationship, as in the case of Marshallian externalities. What this suggests, that Jacobian externalities, so inter-industry benefits, are probably much more, kicking much more at the higher level of population, a higher level of a variety than for the smaller cities. So if you are a bookbinding firm, where do you want to move? And you live in, let's say, Mobile, Alabama, okay? You decide to go north, okay? Where do you want to move? Do you want to move to Albany, New York, which is a mid-sized city, or do you want to move to New York City? Well, it is an important decision. New York City is much more expensive. Rents are much more higher. It's congested rather than Albany, New York, okay? So those are the costs. Benefits, I mean, what our research shows that actually is much more beneficial to go to the large city than the mid-sized city. So if you were to move, okay, and you take advantage of Jacobian externalities, it is a story of, what this graph suggests, it's a story of very, very large cities. Marshallian externalities, not really. Okay, Marshallian externalities, the effect is linear. Okay. So let me start with the regression results. This is I'm going to focus here on the statistical significance and on the sign. Even though these are linear regressions, I will discuss the economic significance later on. So what we see, the specialization on Marshall externalities is significant except for one period and positive. While variety, I mean, really, in the first instance, negative, it's basically all over the place. Okay. We, of course, control for the beginning of a period, very early per worker. We have a state-level manufacturing. We have a city industry dummies. Here we test for the joint significance, and we see that except for one period, I mean, really, both Marshallian and Jacobian externalities do matter. Situation changes quite a bit when we include the second moment of Jacobian externalities. Okay, again, this is parametric regression, so we force the data to follow the U-shaped pattern. What do we have? Okay, so specialization basically remains more or less intact. It's dead. Marshallian externalities matter a lot. Variety we have in not all, but in many decades, there is a clear U-shaped pattern. And when we test for joint significance. It is there. This is what I meant when I said it is reasonably robust. So specialization, almost always, this is significant at 13%. Okay, if I were to push, you know, my academic log, I would say it's at 10%. As for the variety, sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. Okay, but in most of the cases, it is. This is what I mean. It's reasonably robust. Okay. Here we have a two-stage least square instrumental variable variable regression, and let me show you the one when we use both instruments. So again, specialization. The story remains the same, and variety again significance. I mean, drops in some coefficient down, which is the effect of two-stage least square. Again, they are reasonably robust. Okay, in some decades there is nothing. In some decades, there is something. Okay. So what this shows? You are a bookbinding industry. You want to move somewhere to increase your productivity. You go to the city where there is a lot of bookbinding firms. Okay. You think, well, maybe being in the environment of other industries will be beneficial. Let's say in a chemical industry, which comes with a better glue, okay, cheaper glue would be beneficial for me as a bookbinding firm. Where should I go? This result suggests don't go to mid-sized cities, go to very large cities. Okay, that's the point of the story. Now,
What's the idea of the cohort?
I mean, this is the period of the Second Industrial Revolution. We don't have any priors which cohort is better and which is not. Whether 1880, 1920, 1880, 1900. So we argue that it takes at least 20 years for dynamic externalities to really kick in. Okay, in a 10-year period, you don't observe much. So the point of all this is just to explore the robustness of it. If I show you just one decade, you might say, well, I mean, you are cherry picking. No, we try to convince you that this is a consistent story across the Second Industrial Revolution period. Okay, because this is really Second Industrial Revolution. I would say, yeah.
And census data are for each year?
For every 10, census manufacturers was every 10 years until 1902, then it was every 5 years, okay? We didn't have the money to do every 5 years. And second, change in agglomeration economies, change in geography, this is really rather long-running story. So we didn't think that we would gain much of a variation in the data by doing it every 5 years. Okay, now, what about economic significance? So, for the Marshallian externalities, we ask a question, okay, suppose we want to move an industry from a city which is in the 10th percentile of the specialization index to the 90th percentile, what is the effect? And the cumulative growth rate is sometimes between the 5 and 10% depending on the decade. This is a cumulative growth rate, okay? If we move it from the 25th to the 75th percentile, the effect is smaller, between 1.5% to about 3% cumulative growth rate. This is small, but this is not irrelevant. Okay, if me moving from somewhere down in Louisiana to Cleveland can get me 5% growth in labor productivity, I mean, in a generation, I can leave my son a lot of fortune, a lot of wealth. It is a significant effect. Now, for the Jacobian externalities, unfortunately, because of the nonlinearity, we have to look at a particular percentile. Important thing over here, we calculate the city at the, or we figure out what is the city at the turnaround. So this is the city at the lower point of the U-shaped curve. So to get advantage out of Jacobian externalities, you had to be in a city at least as large as Cleveland in the period 1880-1920, at least as large as Detroit in 1919-20. So around the population of more than 100,000, okay, roughly speaking. Okay. So this is really a story of very, very large cities. Now, cumulative growth rate, of course, variety at the 25th percentile, which is on the left side of the U-shaped curve, is going to be negative. You're not going to gain if you move to a small to mid-sized city, but you gain only, and you gain quite a lot, between 3% here, depending on the time period, between 1 and 3%. You gain quite a lot when you move to the very, very, very large city. Okay, so relaxing on parametric assumption, we run a semi-parametric estimation where we don't assume any functional form on the Jacobian externalities. Okay, and for some reason, PDF didn't produce nice confidence intervals. But this is again what I call reasonably robust. So when we look at the U-shaped curve, here is the nicest U-shaped curve. Okay, if we run an envelope over here, we can say it's a U-shaped curve. The same over here, but we can't say anything. Not much over here. We can't say much over here. And this is reasonably all right. All right, U-shaped curve. So again, they are reasonably robust. They are not perfectly robust. Okay, but they are reasonably robust enough for us to start thinking that hold on, there is something going on with the Jacobian externalities. Okay, now, and this is where the transport comes in. So we figure out that it looks like Marshallian externalities mattered more for labor productivity growth during the Second Industrial Revolution, and Jacobian externalities had some effect, but there is some effect. So when Lucas was writing his 1988 paper, when he was talking about the large city, Jacobian externalities, this is the story of large cities and large cities only. And this is an important story. When you look at the level of urbanizations across industrialized world at that time, what we see, it was only United States having a huge cities. There are large cities in Britain, but it's only London which crosses half a million size. So Birmingham, Manchester, Liverpool, they are still relatively small cities. Marshall externalities being big time, playing big role over there, but not Jacobian externalities. Now, can we say something more about the nature of those Marshallian externalities? How did they come into being? Okay, not answering your original question, but to somehow link it to the emergence of the transportation network. Why do we think it might be important? There is a large literature which stresses the role of the falling of railway rates at the time. Especially Alfred Chandler stresses the role of mass production and distribution. We all are the forces which might be conducive to increase of specialization of cities and the increase of the benefits from Marshallian externalities. Okay, so we don't have data on trade costs or transport costs at all. They are not existent. However, we have the data on the travel times between the cities from 1850 until 1920. This was a PhD dissertation for Perez Cervantes from Chicago, and he was kind enough to share the data with us. So what we can calculate, okay, what we have here is a decadal city pairwise travel times. This is in number of days. So how many days it took to get from one city to another, okay? So what he did, he recreated the network structure or railway network structure across the United States for every decade, okay? And then he assumed the constant travel times. Okay, the reason why he assumed constant travel times is because we really don't have much information what was the travel time between Cleveland and Chicago. So he made this assumption. So what is the driving force behind this data is the density of a railway network. So as the network expanded, as the network increased, it was easier and much more faster to get from one city to another. And really it is. I mean, what we see is that for the United States, there is a decline. This is the average travel times across the cities in our sample. And we see there is a quite considerable decline between 1870 and 1900. And we see the biggest decline this is the change average city. Percentage change is between 1880 and 1890. So overall, we do have a decline in the travel time, something that is confirmed across the secondary literature. And so what we ran, we don't claim any causality. We claim a correlation, but we think it is an important correlation. So what we ran over here, we look at the city's average city specialization in the period 1890-1920, and our explanatory variables is a change in the travel times decade before between 1880 and 1890. So what this number says, how much does a change in the travel time in the decade preceding 1890 affects city specialization change between 1890 and 1920? And what we see a significant effect of change in travel times. This number says that if you increase the travel time by one day, then the average city specialization is going to increase by 0.08 percentage points. Okay, this is not trivial. This isn't small. This is actually quite large. So what this regression suggests that change in the travel times or increase in the density of railway network has a positive impact or is positively correlated with the increase in the specialization of cities between 1890 and 1920. Okay, we chose 1890, 1920 as like a baseline for our quantitative exploration, but this relationship holds for other decades as well. Okay, so to conclude, coming to the end. So what the paper examined the effects of agglomeration economies on labor productivity growth. Agglomeration economies or increasing returns to scale economies matter a lot for modern endogenous growth theories. There are cornerstone of those theories, and what we show that Marshallian externalities or intra-industry externalities are always important. irrespective of the time period or estimation techniques, but also Jacobian externalities are important, or inter-industry externalities are important, but they are important only for very large cities. And so when you combine those two effects, really, I mean, large level of urbanization, I mean, had a positive and significant and quite large effect on labor productivities. So substantial urban growth at the turn of the 20th century offered huge productivity advantage, which was not available in other countries and which was not available in the UK. Why am I talking about the UK? Because UK was the industrial leader toward the end of the 19th century. Okay. So also what we show that increase in the specialization is positively related to the increase in the density of transportation network. And this is suggestive that the fall in the transportation cost or fall in the travel times helps to increase specialization at that time. And that's it from me. Thank you.